The Bush administration's interpretation of the doctrine of preemptive military action, hitting someone before they hit you, is under pressure in light of all the controversy about the justification for the Iraq War. The right to strike first in the face of an imminent threat, such as an invasion, is a long-recognized principle. But under President Bush, the concept has been updated to reflect post-9/11 dangers. Critics argue the Iraq experience proves the revised doctrine is flawed. But supporters continue to defend preemption as vital when confronting terrorists and so-called rogue states. Malcolm Brown takes a look at the future of the concept in light of the Iraq experience.
Critics say the Iraq War and the subsequent failure to find any of the actual weapons of mass destruction used as its primary justification have totally undermined the Bush administration's doctrine of preemption. Daryl Kimball is the executive director of the Arms Control Association.
It is, I think, all but impossible to pursue a policy of preemptive military action in other places around the world because we simply do not know enough to know where the weapons are or whether the weapons are there in order to strike them.
But supporters of preemptive military action say the fundamentals remain sound. They include Richard Perle, an influential thinker among those often called neoconservatives, who spoke during a book event at the American Enterprise Institute, where he's a resident fellow.
The lesson of 9/11 was you can wait too long. We saw Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. We saw the camps. We knew that they were preparing acts of terror against us, but we chose not to act.
1 year after the 9/11 attacks, the Bush administration published a new national security strategy, which called for action against emerging threats before they are fully formed. It contained ideas already set out in a 2002 graduation speech delivered by President Bush at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point.
If we wait for threats to fully materialize, we will have waited too long.
The full strategy, published later that year, said that international law had long recognized a nation's right to strike first if faced with clear evidence that an attack was imminent. The strategy document goes on to argue that the concept of imminent threat must be adapted to address the danger posed by rogue states and terrorists armed with weapons of mass destruction. The thinking is that old indicators of an impending attack, like the massing of armies, no longer apply. In his West Point speech, President Bush also argued that the U.S. could no longer rely on the Cold War concepts of deterrence and containment.
Deterrence, the promise of massive retaliation against nations, means nothing against shadowy terrorist networks with no nation or citizens to defend. Containment is not possible when unbalanced dictators with weapons of mass destruction can deliver those weapons on missiles or secretly provide them to terrorist allies.
However, some experts argue that what the Bush administration is now pursuing is not preemption in the traditional sense. Take the Iraq conflict. Professor Anthony Arendt at Georgetown University is an expert on international law as it relates to the use of force. He says that the Iraq invasion looks more like a case of preventive, not preemptive war.
As a general rule, under preemption, there's some clearly well-established sense of imminence. It's going to happen. It's just a matter of when, and when will be fairly soon. When we talk about preventive war, what we're really talking about is using force, using military force against a state that at some point in time might be a threat.
The distinction matters because a preventive use of force has no sanction under international law. In fact, Article 51 of the United Nations Charter talks about the right of self-defense only after an attack has occurred. Whatever you call it, the message from President Bush is that the war on terror will not be won on the defensive. His reasoning is based on a worst-case analysis of future threats, as outlined during a pre-war speech on Iraq delivered in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Understanding the threats of our time, knowing the designs and deceptions of the Iraqi regime, we have every reason to assume the worst, and we have an urgent duty to prevent the worst from occurring.
That analysis is being challenged by some arms control experts in light of what is now known about Iraq's weapons capabilities prior to the invasion. A post-war report by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace accepts that planning for the worst is vital, but it argues that acting on those assumptions could end up making matters worse. Co-author Joseph Cirincione spoke at the report's launch.
Just because we fear that something terrible might occur is no reason to believe that it is in fact likely to occur, particularly when it involves such important matters as war and peace.
Opponents of the Bush administration's brand of preemption also point to the failings of the pre-war evidence gathered against Iraq. How can you back military action when you can't rely on the intelligence, they ask. In a speech defending the CIA from all the criticism it's faced, the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, highlighted the inherent limitations of the job.
In the intelligence business, you are almost never completely wrong or completely right.
But the Carnegie Endowment's president, Jessica Matthews, says you need to be right if, as with Iraq, the intelligence is central to the case for war.
In this case, the world's three best intelligence agencies, the United States, Great Britain, and Israel, were unable to provide that level of certainty.
Jessica Matthews called for the U.S. to abandon its doctrine of preemption. What worries critics of the Bush administration is that the national security strategy seeks to change the concept of an imminent threat without providing a clear new definition. The fear is that the U.S. will use the doctrine to justify unilateral military action around the world. Professor Anthony Arendt at Georgetown University argues it would be better for the U.S. to address terrorist threats through the United Nations.
As we start to relax that particular concept of imminence, then we get into a gray area which becomes very, very scary when one state decides to take those actions. And that's why I think going to a multilateral body makes a lot more sense.
Supporters of preemption advise the critics to look at how the U.S. is approaching other international problems. Gary Schmidt, the executive director of the Project for the New American Century, points to North Korea, Iran, and Libya as cases where concerns about weapons of mass destruction are being addressed peacefully.
I don't think the world has to worry about the U.S. rampaging around, you know, sort of looking for shadows and, you know, and acting on shadows. It's more likely if you look at the what's going on in the world today that they're actually being reserved in the use of military power and secondarily using other means to try to address these same problems.
And in an article in Foreign Affairs magazine earlier this year, the U.S. Secretary of State accused the critics of exaggeration. Colin Powell rejects claims that preemption is central to U.S. strategy. He argues that it's not so much the policy that's new, it's the fact that it has now been stated so explicitly. For Common Ground, I'm Malcolm Brown in Washington.